All right. Well, then let's start with what's your musical background?
A musical background. Basically, just some piano lessons as a kid, high school brass band, French horn, a little bit of trumpet. Nothing really, no real training. The music career started when I was an orderly in a mental asylum in Australia, and I started a band up as a part of a music therapy course with three of the patients, and we became quite a popular punk band in Australia. I then went on more or less on my own to Europe, I guess about nearly 10 years, from about 79 to 89, doing my own sort of industrial music recording project called SPK.
Mm-hmm.
And then got very lucky. Philip Noyce and George Miller heard my stuff and asked me to do Dead Calm. So there started the composition career.
Okay.
Odd way to get there.
Yeah, very odd way. What at first inspired you to write film and television music?
I guess I was in the early 80s, about 82, I started to write an album called, the title for it was Music for Impossible Films. I really, really used to love listening to the music on movies, and I never thought anybody would ask me to do it, not really being, you know, a classically trained musician or a conductor or anything. And so I started to write this music, which was somewhat more ambient. The record eventually came out and was called Songs of Byzantine Flowers. And one of the pieces on there was actually the basis of the Dead Calm score,
mm-hmm.
which got picked up was in about 88, 89. So I was already writing pieces for movies, even though there were no movies.
Okay, well, what is the first thing you do when you begin to write a score?
Watch the film, watch the sequence of the film that I'm working on. You know, I have a real feel for what it should be. I don't quite hear the melodies in my head, but I hear all the orchestration, all the sounds, and the basic rhythm of the piece. So by the time I finish watching the movie, I've started to hear it already.
Hmm.
And then once they, you know, give me the movie, I start more or less building a palette of sounds. And my style is not to use the same palette over and over and over again. I tend to change it around a lot, and so just loading a lot of samplers and get started, you know, putting some weird stuff down.
Okay. Well, I first became of your work on the score of The Crow.
Oh,
so
yeah.
How did you first become? How did you first come to work on that project?
I guess I was introduced to that movie by Jolene Cherry, who was working. She was the music supervisor on the project, and I was already friends with Alex Proyas back from Australia days.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted somebody that was, you know, really familiar with all the kinds of bands that they wanted to put on the soundtrack. And having come from that, more or less being one of the people that invented industrial music,
mm-hmm.
the bands had a lot of trust in me, and I could also work as a go-between between the music supervisor and director, who really didn't see eye to eye very much. And so I was the go-between, having sort of figured out how these really heavy bands would go in the movie. I sort of saw it as my task to give the light and shade. There was a lot of shade, not much light.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I chose to write with choir and female voice and you know, a real nice little waltz time string suite.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, managed to integrate the whole thing in a lot of strange world music instruments and in with the rock and roll.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have a question for you in regards to that actual soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
On that, on the actual soundtrack itself, there is a small portion of a song called It Can't Rain All the Time.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who performed that? Was that actually Brandon Lee, or was that someone else?
No. It was, who played guitar? I don't remember who played guitar. It wasn't Brandon.
Mm.
No, that was probably Carl Verhoeven, I think, is the guitarist I used to use at that time.
Okay.
And James Siberry sang the song eventually on the other record.
All right. Well, you actually did come back and score the sequel. So what are the considerations that go into writing a score for a sequel?
In that case, they essentially wanted to hear very similar ideas. It was the first one had been just so amazingly successful that they said, we don't want to do change a thing. And it's like, well, it's quite hard to do. I don't mind using the same. In fact, I was forced to use the same theme because they had not enough money to record any orchestra at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'd paid for the orchestra on the first one myself. So I thought, okay, it's okay to give the through line of the character, seeing it's a different actor. But in this case, it was set in, you know, at the Day of the Dead. So I did use a more of the Mexican element, more choral, I think. It was more of slightly more religious than the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I don't think the director had a very good handle on the story, so it wasn't quite so successful.
Mm. You do have a very unique style when it comes to orchestration. What are the considerations that go into your instrument choice?
I don't know. It's almost like an innate thing. I hear it. I think it's like you hear some other composers say they just hear the melodies. I tend to be hearing more texture than melody, though the melody does come pretty easy once I know what it is that I'm using. But to me, all these things just go together. I've always thought about it. Maybe it's, I don't know where it comes from. Possibly coming from New Zealand, where I come from, it's one of the youngest countries in the world, and we really have no music tradition there at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of the reasons why I called that record I was talking about Songs of Byzantine Flowers, because
yes.
Byzantium at the time was really the crossroads of culture. You know, there were instruments and voices coming down from Russia, up from Persia, west from China and the Silk Road, and then there was the whole Eastern European tradition that sort of merged there, and I feel that really defines what I do, is that here I am, I'm in a country where there's almost a blank slate, but there's the internet, there's TV, radio, satellite, and here it all is, the world is here, even though none of it really belongs to my tradition,
mm-hmm.
So therefore it all does, and that's the way I look at it, is that even though I treat it with respect, for example, I'll never use Arabic music because the Arabs are bad guys kind of thing. You know, I see it as a spiritual tradition. You know, just love delving into it and exploring something that I don't know about.
Okay.
It's kind of my inspiration, I think, just trying to find new, just trying to learn.
Okay. Well, now, one of my favorite scores of yours is Red Planet, yet it seems to go against the standard of what would be considered a sci-fi score.
Right.
Why did you choose that approach for Red Planet?
Even the director, Anthony Hoffman, said to me, so, you know, ultimately we have a schlep movie here. He was, I think, somewhat dissatisfied with the way the script evolved.
Hmm.
And he said, you know, he was lots of things that he wanted to do, he didn't have the budget to do. So he just said, you know what, go with it and make this a much more operatic, much more beautiful, interesting experience than what you actually see on the screen.
Hmm.
You know? To a composer, that's like, oh, okay. I'm not constrained anymore. You know, just I just wanted to also to. It seemed like a journey into purgatory or a journey into hell. So I was a little bit inspired by Dante and used some of his words and asked Emma Chaplin to do some singing and had a lot of fun on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it definitely comes through. It's actually been one of my favorite scores. It constantly starts appearing in my car every once in a while.
Okay.
I'll be driving along, and I'll just go, this is a fantastic score.
Thank you. It's one of those driving records, isn't it?
It definitely
is. The Malibu Canyon or the desert in Arizona.
Exactly.